So, yeah, I'm going to introduce somebody who's one of my heroes, one of my role models, you might say, called Atisha, who was he's actually from India, but he was Tibetan. He spent quite a bit of his life in Tibet, so he's sort of renowned, really, for the time. Part of his life he spent going to Tibet and, in a way, reintroducing the Dharma in Tibet, and the way he did that. He's a figure on our refuge tree of the Western Buddhist Order, which I gather you've been having talks about really for quite some time already. So they've got a picture of the refuge tree on the shrine over there. So above Shakyamuni the Buddha, there's a whole bank of about 18 teachers from different countries: Japan, China, India, and Tibet. And the teachers on the third tier up from the bottom. There, one of the Tibetan teachers. Yeah, if you ask for ordination or when you join the order, there's a practice which involves visualizing that refuge tree, and it's a practice I've done quite a bit at times, and I've really enjoyed sort of contemplating the richness of all those figures, and it almost feels like they're a bit like my spiritual family, I suppose, sort of spiritual ancestors. And yeah, it's just quite lovely sometimes just to sit and sort of be absorbed in their qualities, their sort of benevolence or their attributes. And so there's the actual human figures. There's a sort of, in a way, historical handing down of inspiration and understanding from Shakyamuni via all these historical figures to us now. How we practice the Dharma has been really formed by those people in some ways, or how we understand it. And then there's a bit like there's this mandala, timeless mandala of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, within which these historical figures exist as well. So the refuge tree is really a very rich symbol, very beautiful symbol, I think. It's really three-dimensional, so when you see it sort of flat like that, it's actually like a three-dimensional mandala, the whole thing, if you imagine it like that. And, yeah, I've sometimes felt when I've been sort of meditating on that, on the refuge tree, on that symbol, all those Buddhas, those Bodhisattvas, and some of those particular teachers, I've got to know what their lives were like and what they contributed and what their inspirations were. It's felt a bit like my spiritual home. So I was saying to somebody the other day, when I went on my round the year travel, sometimes I felt a bit at sea. I didn't know where I was, but I would sometimes meditate on the refuge tree, and then I felt, this is where I am. And it gave me a context just to be anywhere somehow. It was my spiritual home. Yeah, so there's 18. So Sankaracharya, who was here giving a talk a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, founder of our movement, and he chose the figures on that tree. I'm not entirely sure why with all of them. Have to make a few guesses. Certainly... each of those human teachers, those teachers from the past, you can sort of see that they've made enormous contributions to, in a way, the understanding of the Dharma in a particular age, because it's a bit like there's this timeless Dharma, Buddhist teachings, but they seem to need sort of translating into particular cultures and times. So each of those people, I think they're a bit like a translator. I know Sangharakshita thinks of himself as a translator, sort of translating the fundamental Dharma into something we can understand in our day-to-day lives, we can put into practice. And in a way, that's something we all need to do as well, translate the Dharma into something that works for us and something we can talk about with others. Yeah. And so in a way, amongst us, there will be people who become translators of the Dharma in this age. And perhaps one day some of us will be on a refuge tree in the future. Who knows? It's an exciting thought. Because we're not the end, are we? Hopefully we're not the end anyway. We won't go into that. But anyway, hopefully there are cultures to come. And in a way, I also see it as a sort of responsibility, really, to try and understand the Dharma as clearly and as deeply as I can in order to... in a way, I suppose I think of it more as living it a little bit, perhaps. I'm not sure if that's what Prabhupada meant earlier on, but trying to live the Dharma and bring it alive in my life as much as possible in an ordinary sort of way, so that it can be sort of caught or brought alive in that way, and sort of passed on in that sense. So I think Atisha did that, yes. So he was from India. Apparently he was one of the last great Buddhist pandits or acharyas. It's a great teacher at the great monastic universities of India. So in the 11th, 12th century in India. But apparently there were these very, very big colleges, monastic colleges, which were like a university, but they were also great spiritual practice places. And Atisha was one of the teachers, or initially a student, I suppose, and then became a teacher at one of those colleges. But yes, even so, he's best known for the time he spent in Tibet. He arrived actually in Tibet at the age of 60, but his contribution to the Dharma is he's best known for what he did after he was 60, between his 60 and maybe 70-something year, which is something I think is a good thing to ponder on, actually, that it could be that the best or the most productive years of our lives might be in our 60s and 70s. And so not to write ourselves off too soon. We may have years of sort of contribution to the welfare of beings ahead of us. So at the age of 60, he undertook a reformation, really, of Tibetan Buddhism as it then was. Yes, because although Buddhism had sort of been transplanted, as it were, to Tibet, partly by Padmasambhava, the great teacher in the 8th century, it went through a long phase of persecution after that. There were some kings of Tibet who were not at all inclined towards Buddhism. In fact, they were really sort of the opposite. Were very anti, and actually, burnt down monasteries and killed lots of the monks, and Buddhism was almost died out in Tibet, in fact, by the 10th century. So Atisha arrived in Tibet around that sort of time and managed to sort of calm things down and bring a new level of depth of practice and understanding of the Dharma in Tibet, and from which Tibetan Buddhism, as we now know it, really flourished and came alive. So without him, perhaps there might not have been the sort of Tibetan Buddhism that we know now. Yes. Yeah. So he seemed quite a multifaceted sort of character. He obviously had a very, very clear mind, a great mind. He was a philosopher. And he seemed to be someone who could bring together different strands of philosophy into one coherent practice, which is quite a talent, I think. But he also was somebody with a very warm heart. I suppose that's what's touched me about him. He had a very great heart, it seems. Obviously I'm going to say a bit about his life, and I feel he really, to me, he exemplifies somebody who is a true bodhisattva, somebody who's giving of their life for the welfare of all beings, and he seemed to live that out in his life. So I found his life very inspiring, and his teaching, you often in his teachings there's an accent on kindness and compassion. I suppose it's my name, isn't it? Maybe that's why I'm attracted to this. But I think everyone's attracted to kindness and compassion, aren't they? But again and again, he exhorts his disciples to practice kindness and to think of others. And in fact, one of the teachings that he's best known for, I think, these days with us is a teaching called the 7-Point Mind Training, which some of you may have heard of. It came initially from, I'll say a bit more about, I think, how he came to learn or understand that teaching himself and pass it on to his disciples. The 7-Point Mind Training is a path of sort of precepts that you live out in your life, and also meditations and reflections that help to cultivate this bodhicitta, the sort of heart of enlightenment that is full of compassion for being other all beings. It's a very intensive, systematic sort of practice, working on yourself to sort of, in a way, to sort of get to see what stands in your way. In a way, it throws up. It's a very, very positive practice, but it throws up your demons in front of you, allows you to see your ego, and therefore, helps you in a way to purify yourself of the things that stand in your way of being more compassionate. And the essence of that practice is there's a little phrase called the exchange of self and others, which I thought I'd ask Munisha to read a few. She's going to do a couple of readings for me. Read some verses from a text called the Bodhicharya Avatara, which is the text from which our Sevenfold Puja has been taken, those of you who've come across the Sevenfold Puja. And that was written by Shantideva, who's another of the great figures on the refuge tree, in fact, who lived a few centuries before Atisha. So I think that these verses show you the sort of essence of the teaching in a better way than I'll be able to express them. Right, the mic. Okay.
At first, one should meditate intently on the equality of oneself and others as follows. All equally experience suffering and happiness. I should look after them as I do myself. I should dispel the suffering of others because it is suffering like my own suffering. I should help others too because of their nature as beings, which is like my own being. When happiness is liked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I strive after happiness only for myself? When fear and suffering are disliked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I protect myself and not the other? Whoever longs to rescue quickly both himself and others should practice the supreme mystery, exchange of self and other. If I give, what shall I have left to enjoy? Such concern for one's own welfare is fiendish. If I enjoy, what shall I give? Such concern for the welfare of others is divine.
So those sort of qualities that we've heard just there were the very essence of the sort of practices that Atisha was himself practicing very, very hard, and also teaching to others, and those have come down through the centuries to us. But the other quality about Atisha I've been very moved by is his devotion to the Bodhisattva Green Tara, who's my own Iadam. So I took on the practice as a visualization practice, which we can take on when we are ordained. If we'd like to do that, to visualise a Buddha or a Bodhisattva form. So I've taken on that practice myself of Green Tara. And I've been quite touched by hearing, in a way, how with Atisha himself, he was very, very devotional. And somehow I don't always think of great scholars as being very, very devotional. It sort of feels very sort of receptive, or, I don't know, quite touching quality somehow. And he would always ask Tara her advice on big decisions he was going to take in his life. So she would reply. But I think, I don't know if you've ever tried anything like that. I have found myself that I can ask and you will get a reply. But I won't say any more about that, but it's not always the reply you're expecting. Mind you, but also you have to ask not lightly. Yeah, you can't do it as an experiment. I think it's a bit if you want to call on Tara or call on the Bodhisattva, you have to really mean it. But then you do get definitely an immediate response of some sort. But Atisha often apparently saw visions of Tara and from his early boyhood, and she sort of steered the course of his life. So I'm dedicating this talk to Tara and the principle of compassion, the force of compassion in the world, and may it come into being more and more in our midst, in this very place. So although I'm moving on to tell a little bit about his life story now, although he lived about 1,000 years ago, actually his life seems to be fairly well documented, and that's apparently partly because in Tibet apparently they were actually quite good at writing biographies and they were interested in people's lives, whereas apparently the Indians, there's no information about him when he was at the Indian monastery, but it's all coming from his Tibetan disciples because they had a different way of looking at life, and they were much more interested in biography. Even so, the accounts of his life can seem a little bit mythologized, is that the right word? Or to our Western way of thinking, but perhaps they seem quite real, I don't know, over there in the East. There are sort of aspects of his life story, but there's also his teachings which have come through to us, even some of his actual words, so it's said. So we do get quite a strong sense of him as a person. And the sense I get is of somebody actually very down to earth, with a very strong practice of ethics and meditation and friendship and kindness, very, very much grounded. But also seems to be quite a visionary. He sort of breaks out into spontaneous poetry. One time he does that, arriving on the border of Tibet when he'd been travelling by elephant for quite some time. 3 years apparently, to get to Tibet, and must be quite sore by then. And the Tibetans meet him there with full ceremony, and they offer him a cup of Tibetan tea in a beautiful mug with a dragon on it, it's actually described. And he breaks out into a spontaneous poem because he loves this tea so much. So he obviously went, I imagined he would have won the hearts of the Tibetans straight away, wouldn't they? Have this sort of yak tea, the yak milk. Rancid yak milk tea, don't they? So apparently takes a bit of getting used to, but he liked it straight away. But anyway, he was quite a sort of a poetic person. And there's another account when he first got to the major monastery that was still standing in Tibet, and he walked around with the great abbot of the day, and he came out with these spontaneous verses of uplift at all the different statues of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that he saw. He would just somehow create, you know, completely on the moment compose a hymn of praise to each one. So he's quite a balanced sort of character. So he was apparently born in East Bengal in 982 of the Christian era, that is to say. And the accounts of his life, it sounds pretty fabulous really, but taking it with a pinch of salt, all the descriptions of palaces and countless houses he had for different times of the year, and bathing pools encircled with gardens, forests, and golden victory banners. Anyway, it seems likely he was born in quite a well-to-do family, but I don't want to sort of lower the tone too much. Maybe a princely family in East Bengal, which is that's now Bangladesh, isn't it? He was quite near Dhaka, apparently, right in Bangladesh. And he was given the name Chandragarbha at his birth. And apparently he grew to be extraordinarily beautiful and charming in his youth, which is apparently does seem to be borne out actually in later years, because you get quite a few descriptions of him from later on, that he had a bearing of a lot of grace and beauty, and always had a sort of quite a serene smile on his face. So yeah, even at the age of 60 when he's travelling to Tibet, there's a description of him like that. So he probably was somebody who was quite well graced in a way, with a pleasing human form that was and a nice, pleasant sort of disposition. But yes, he had visions of Tara from his boyhood apparently, and he wanted, although his parents didn't want him to, he wanted to leave home and practice the Dharma, leave worldly life and seek a Buddhist teacher, which is eventually what he did. So it's interesting actually how Buddhism was at that time in India. It was very, in a way, very refined in a certain sort of way, very sophisticated, and it had got a bit of a long way from a down-to-earth practice of the precepts and meditation, whatever. It was what we'd think of as a Vajrayana, tantric Buddhism. So lots of very complicated rituals and ceremonies and visualizations of all sorts of weird and wonderful Buddha and Bodhisattva figures. So this is the realm of type of Buddhism that Tathisha met, and he went. His first teacher then was a tantric yogi called Rahula Gupta, who lived in the Black Mountains. So it sounds like it was quite a big jump from his palace. Apparently in a place quite near where the Vultures Peak is, for those of you who know, who've been to India or know the near Rajgir, where the Buddha taught the Dharma. He received tantric ordination about 16, and he apparently threw himself really wholeheartedly into his practice, and sounds like he was a very deep and deep meditator. And his last 3 years were spent with the Dakinis in Uddiyana. It seems like the Dakinis might have been a training ground, a sort of tantric training ground in northwest India. And the Dakinis, well, I think there were a lot of the female practitioners were perhaps the teachers at that place. And he became a great tantric adept. But then at the age of 29, apparently he had a dream of the Buddha who was saying to him he should seek ordination as a bhikkhu. So that would have been more in the tradition of early Buddhism. It's in a saffron-robed, precept-taking bhikkhu that we're perhaps a bit more familiar with from the East. And he does do that. He listens to his dream, and he goes and receives ordination in the Mahasanghika school, and he's given a new name, which is Dipankara Srinyana. And that's the name he keeps really throughout the rest of his life. And this name, a teacher that he's known by, is a sort of an honorific title he was given. It actually means great lord, so it's not his personal name, which was Dipankara. So he goes to one of the big monastic colleges that I was mentioning earlier, and he studies and trains for many years, particularly throwing himself into practice of meditation, mindfulness, and Savastivadin Abhidharma. That's very in-depth, very detailed sort of Dharma study. So in a way, he's gone right from one extreme to the other, hasn't he? Sort of tantric meditation in the mountains with this tantric yogi to this sort of what can seem like perhaps quite a sort of dry but very principled and highly structured life in a monastery. But then another big change happens in his life. It's hard to know quite, you know, what sparks it off, but he takes the vows of a bodhisattva from his teacher in that monastic college, his teacher Dharmarakshita. And that seems to set him off on a journey to, in a way, find teachings which will help him to cultivate the bodhicitta, that will help him to really realise his wish to be a bodhisattva. Actually, it's these teachings of which are encompassed really in that reading we've just had, and the seven-point mind training. And he decides to go and seek a teacher who lives in Sumatra, which it turns out to be 14 months. It's 14 months' journey away. So, yes, he decides to sort of set sail. So the next we see of him, he's on this merchant ship setting out on a very long voyage. And in the name of the island where Sumatra was is called I forgot what its Sanskrit name was, but it was translated as the Golden Isles. So I always find this quite I don't know, it's quite a sort of mythic sort of feel to it, sort of setting sail to the Golden Isles to search for the bodhicitta, search for the bodhisattva's way of life. And he finds there eventually, his teacher Dharmakirti, who's renowned for his teachings and practices leading to the bodhicitta. But it is a long and arduous journey. So on the way, this is quite well documented in the Tibetan biography about all the storms that come up on the journey. And at one point the ship is caught in a great tempest and thrown about by the wind and the waves, and then another time it becomes completely becalmed and unable to move. So a teacher's just in the ship and just getting thrown around, can't do anything. Then enemies of the Dharma appear in the storm, hurling thunderbolts at the boat. or take the shape of great leviathans in the ocean. And the crew members, knowing that Atisha is a great tantric yogi, they call on him to subdue these hostile forces. And he does this by transforming his body into that of a wrathful deity and hurling vajras in all directions. The enemies are subdued and promise not to obstruct Atisha's path any further. And they convert to the Dharma themselves. Then 21 maidens appear in the sea singing to Atisha. And it's the 21 Taras who show themselves having helped Atisha in the battle with the evil forces. So it's quite a journey, isn't it? And yep. I was thinking, I mean, we're so bored of psychological, aren't we, in our era? But perhaps it was something to do with, it could have been, you know, in a way, it's Atisha's inner journey as well as his outer journey. And I imagine on a 14 month journey to seek your teacher, you might well have a lot going on, mightn't you? And he wasn't already enlightened, so a lot of resistance perhaps coming up. And just seeing his own ego, his greed, hatred and delusion, just slamming itself against the masts and the sea, and he couldn't really get away. But, yeah, I think perhaps, who knows which is more real as an interpretation? I don't know. Yeah. But, I was just also reflecting how amazing to decide to travel so far in such a... And actually, it was a perilous journey, a dangerous journey, just in order to hear the Dharma, or whether we would do that, or what would that mean, what's an equivalent for us, a decision that we might have to take, or what, you know, would we put ourselves aside in that way or make that decision, what would help us to do that. So when you got there to Sumatra, to the Golden Isles, his teacher said he could only stay if he would stay for 12 years to practice and cultivate the bodhicitta, and so he agreed, and that's what he did. And at that time he was actually learning a vast range of teachings, which actually stood him in good stead when he went to Tibet, and in a way reformed the whole of the Tibetan Buddhism there. And this teacher, Dharmakirti, apparently was very, very dear to him. Again, it was quite moving reading about the relationship the love he had for his teacher, that later on in life he couldn't speak of his teacher without bursting into tears, because he was so dear to him, he was so revered his teacher, and was so grateful to what he learnt from him, or just by practicing at his side. But he did eventually, he came back to India. He was 44 years old by then, and he went again to one of those other monastic colleges, Vikram Shila, where he was the principal teacher, Pandit Acharya. And we've got a little snippet which Munish is going to read now, which describes how he was then. A Tibetan had actually gone to the college and saw Atisha there, and describes how he saw him, which is quite nice to have, get another little sense of him.
His graceful appearance and smiling face struck every one of the assembly. From his waist hung down a bundle of keys. The Indians, Nepalese and Tibetans all looked at him and took him for a countryman of their own. Even the gods would own him for their own. There was brightness mixed with simplicity of expression in his face, which acted as a magic spell upon those who beheld him. In the following morning, I went to the door of a vihara. While I was reciting the Prajñāsāra, a venerable acharya with bright looks and smiles in his face entered the vihara. Observing the simple, unostentatious demeanour which marked him, I resolved within myself, if we fail to take Atisha to our country, this pundit might as well serve our purpose. Next morning, I happened to be at the place where that venerable acharya was distributing alms and food to the poor and making offerings to spirits. A beggar boy, who failed to get his share of alms, ran after him and exclaimed, "Blessed be thou, O patron Atisha, give me rice." Hearing this, I became delighted. Tears of joy flowed from my eyes. I followed him as he walked towards his place, and was about to fall from a bridge while walking over it, my attention being wholly engrossed upon Atisha.
So that's a rather lovely account, isn't it? Just imagine sort of walking along and so following your the person who's you admire so much, falling off a bridge. Yeah. So time goes by. We won't tell him about every single year of his life, otherwise we'll be here all night. But at the age of 56, there came another big turning point in his life. And by now he was the greatest teacher, acharya, of his time in India, had many disciples. And he could no doubt have continued to develop his own teaching and deepen his own insight in that familiar environment. But a sort of challenge or a request came to him from the Tibetan people. So it seems actually that Atisha had been approached once before already by the Tibetans to go to their country to help with that situation I mentioned earlier, where the Dharma was pretty much, was on a very, very low ebb, almost died out, really. But he'd said he had too much work to do already in India. But the Tibetans came again, a contingent of monks came from Tibet and asked Atisha again. So I thought we could maybe just imagine this scene. There's a young Tibetan monk called Nagso has come to meet Atisha in his room, and he makes this the request on behalf of the Tibetan king. So we've got this great Atisha, 57 years old, probably very, perhaps a lot of charisma, strong, awe-inspiring presence, and the young Tibetan monk Nagso with his small retinue, and he's apparently arranging a mandala of gold in front of Atisha to make an offering to him. And he proceeds to tell Atisha the story of Tibet and what's happening there at the moment. And what he's saying is that Tibetan Buddhism has come to a state of great crisis. There are serious wrong views about of the nature of the Dharma, as well as a big fragmentation in the whole country. There's been quite a sort of corrupt tantric Buddhism which has been spread in Tibet at that time, and there's one sect which apparently taught a practice called union and liberation, which was interpreted by them as rape and human sacrifice. So I guess it was that sort of tantric idea that if you're, in a sense, if you're being yourself and expressing your nature, then it's liberation. But people were seriously confused about what was the Dharma and what wasn't the Dharma. So the Dharma itself was coming into disrepute because people were saying this was Buddhism, this type of serious misunderstanding was giving Buddhism a bad name. There was a king in Western Tibet, though, called Yeshe Zod, who was really trying hard to restore Buddhism. And he'd actually organised for some young Tibetans to go to India and train in monasteries in India and learn to translate texts and come back to Tibet. But most of them had died because of the difference in climate. The Tibetans couldn't live very long in India. They'd get these diseases, and the heat of the plains was very, very difficult for them. One of them had come back, who was a great tantric scholar, Rinchen Zangpo. And I don't know if anybody has read The Way of the White Clouds by Anagarika Govinda. It's a very, very beautiful book about his journey in Tibet, and he finds a long abandoned monastery called Saparang and a golden temple at Tholin, which are sort of decaying, and they're full of these magnificent murals, which is his wife proceeds to trace the murals. And it's very, very, it's crumbling every day, and she's tracing these very, very beautiful murals and very, very beautiful Buddha figures. And that temple was created by this great monk, apparently, Rinchen Zangpo. But he was now in his 90s, and there wasn't much hope, in a way, for Tibet at that time. So Yeshe Zod, this great Western, this king of Western Tibet, he was thinking, although they tried, they won an invitation to a teacher and had failed, that it had failed because they'd offered too little gold, perhaps. And so he organised a fundraising expedition and went round Tibet to raise funds. But he fell into the hands of some enemies when he was doing it. Unfortunately, those enemies demanded a huge ransom for him, and that was almost the amount of gold that, you know, he'd been raising to seek for Atisha. But the king's son started collecting funds to ransom his father. But when he actually went to his father, they found that he still hadn't got enough money. So his father was, you know, in a way, he was getting old himself, and he decided to. He asked his son to keep the money to go and take it to Atisha and ask Atisha to come, that he would die soon anyway, and it was more important that Atisha came to Tibet and re-established the Dharma there. So, and he did actually die shortly afterwards in captivity still. So of course when he heard that story, you know, Atisha was very moved and felt the king had been a bodhisattva, not accepting his own release, but asking for Atisha to come instead and to help the Dharma to re-establish. And so Atisha did decide to go to Tibet. But he also, before he really finally decided, he consulted Tara as well. And as to what the outcome would be for him and for the Dharma if he goes to Tibet. So I thought I'd chant the Tara invocation again at this point, as we're consulting Tara. Where is the Tara invocation? Literally, get me, Sarika. Save me unravelling myself. So he goes to a great temple of Tara and invokes her response to the question. We could all shut our eyes at this point to sort of take ourselves into the atmosphere of what that would be. Bhutalai nai chokne tam yik changku lai tung shing tam yik oki do wa do do ma ko che sheik su so la dang la min cho pen ji shap ki pe mo la tu ne pong pa kun le do te ma Do ma hyum la chak sao lo. So Tara had a very, very positive response to Atisha going to Tibet. For the Tibetan people, she said it would be very, very beneficial. But that if Atisha did go to Tibet, his life would be shortened by 20 years. So that was, again, a decision that he needed to take, whether he was willing to do that. And he did, as we know, he went to Tibet. He did take that step. So moved was he by, in a way, the need of the people there. So that we do now find Atisha on his second great mythic journey on this elephant. I think he might have gone by yak later, actually. I think it might not be an elephant the whole way. So he's on an elephant and he's going all the way through Nepal and en route to Tibet. And everywhere he's going, people ask him to teach the Dharma. So it takes ages, you know, much, much longer than it would have been. So he goes to a kingdom and the king won't let him get past unless he, you know, spends at least several months there teaching them all the Dharma. So everywhere he goes, he's teaching. And then he arrives at the border, has his cup of tea, as we've heard, I thought it was interesting. I've written down here, Padmasambhava converted Tibet by subduing demons, and Atisha did it by praising tea. It's a different way in, isn't it? A different approach. Different ways to convert a country. Yeah, his kindness. So his kindness was a great attribute, a great aspect of Atisha. And he really did seem to win the hearts of people that he met with this, with his kindness, his simplicity, and a sort of radiance, it seems, that he had. And he even talked to animals, apparently. So he was very aware of all beings, and he didn't just teach monks and nuns, which I think some people at that time, you know, the monastic circle, it was quite refined and a bit away from the people in general. But Atisha would teach lay people and monks and even animals. And a saying of his which really sums up these qualities, he said, "If you have any desire at all, have a desire for kindness. If you have any desire at all, have the desire for kindness." So his practice was very down to earth. And there's a book called the Door of Liberation, which has quite a lot of his sayings in, if you want to read any of them later on. And there's one, it's very human actually, there's one where he's saying rather ruefully that his students only seem keen to receive teachings, but when it comes to putting them into practice, it's another thing, another matter. So things don't really change, do they? That's just what we're like as well. It's always interesting getting a new teaching, but actually when it comes to, you know, the hard grinding work of day-to-day practice, it's not quite so attractive, is it, really? But we have our good moments, don't we? And another saying of his about meditation. "While meditating, do not count the number of years and months devoted to it. Rather, try to find out how much or how little self-knowledge you have received in your mind, and how much or how little control you have acquired over your habits." So he sort of, you know, he's not a superficial teacher or practitioner. He gets right down. He really wants people to change, doesn't he? He really wants people to transform and take the Dharma to their hearts. Yes. Towards the end of his life, he passes on a lot of his teachings to a Tibetan disciple, who then starts the school called the Kadampa School, which then in its few centuries down the line, it becomes the Gelugpa School, which is has been one of the mainstream schools in Tibetan Buddhism. So I won't sort of go into, I had a whole chunk here about his teachings, but that gets a little bit detailed. So I was wondering about, he spent these 13 years into Tibet before he died. So he did die, I think it sounds like, when he was about 73. And he travelled all over Tibet, sort of teaching everybody he met. And it seems like Tibetan Buddhism sort of reshaped itself around him, like he was a bit like one of these very clarifying and harmonising force, actually. I think because his understanding of the Dharma was quite deep. He was able to reconcile the different sort of approaches and sects. He was actually known as the refuge guru because he taught the primacy of going for refuge, rather as Bhante has done for us, that in your spiritual practice, your commitment to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha is the first thing, and sort of how you do it is secondary. And so he brought people together by saying that. I think we've all got this tendency to polarise, haven't we? So my way's best and your way is not working. Sort of very human, but Atisha really wanted people to sort of harmonise and come together. But yes, I sort of wondered if he'd stayed in India, whether he would have achieved as much as he did in going to Tibet, actually. It's hard to know. He might have lived another 20 years, but would he have really given so much to the world? And I thought probably going to Tibet would have drawn a lot more out of him, wouldn't it, than the situation of staying in a fairly sort of safe environment in India in that college. We don't really know, but again, it's something to think about. But we see the significance of his action as well, was that only a couple of hundred years later, those great monasteries in India were wiped out by the Muslim invasion, as well as the fact that they actually were decaying through a sort of... It seems that they weren't that alive spiritually on the whole. And as I said, there was this beginning to be quite a distancing between the sort of population and the monks and nuns. Presumably were nuns. Those were some nuns. The monks and the nuns. So when the Muslim invasion came and these monasteries were wiped out, there wasn't much sort of local Buddhism being practiced, and Buddhism itself died out in India very shortly afterwards. All the teachings and the scriptures and the rupas and things in the monasteries were sort of burnt and destroyed, and it was the Dharma texts that were taken to places like Tibet and China and Southeast Asia, which kept the written Dharma alive for us, actually, because it didn't really continue in India. It's quite a shocking thought. I think if the teacher hadn't gone to Tibet, all the Dharma that was taken to Tibet wouldn't perhaps have been there for us now. So his contribution was, you can't look ahead so far, and perhaps Tara did, look ahead so far to see what's going to be of benefit. Yeah. So yes. So the 60s and 70s in our lives might be our best. We might achieve our most. Well, I guess you've got... I'm in my 50s at the moment, so I'm looking forward to that. But, they do say your 50s can be the best years of your life. I guess you've got that sort of bit more maturity, haven't you? And as well as quite a bit of life experience. And then if you're still healthy, you can... Don't put things off, of course. Yeah. And the other thing I thought about of a T-shirt, well, he obviously wasn't born a Bodhisattva, too. He actually made himself... He created himself, in a way, as the being that he became. He's not like Padmasambhava, who was, they say he was born on a lotus, but perhaps that, he seems like more of a mythic figure. But for me, Atisha is a very human figure, human being who just achieved a lot and had a very, very solid heart, very real kindness and compassion, which was, it sounds like it was just fundamentally of incredible depth. And for me, that is somebody who's a Bodhisattva, who's got that ability to lead his life, lead his or her life, without deviating, just for the benefit of what he or she sees to be the good, responding to suffering where it's seen. So I'll end with... I was going to say another of his sayings, actually, before I end with this other saying, but he had another lovely, very useful saying. It was, let's see, how does it go? There's no end to things to do, so limit your activities. There's no end of things to do or to be done, so limit your activities. Otherwise you just get overrun by them, don't you? So that is a very wise comment. If you have any desire at all, have the desire for kindness. Thank you.